And it's high noon in Belfast, Maine. This is Belfast Community Radio, WBFY 100.9 FM in Belfast, Maine, streaming live at belfastcommunityradio.org. I am Jennifer Hill, and the show is Finding Common Ground, and we're happy to welcome Elizabeth Garber, author of Implosion, Memoir of an Architect's Daughter.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you here. So, your father was an architect, and you grew up in a glass house. How long did this story take to gel in your mind about that you wanted to tell in this way?
Well, I never wanted to tell this story.
Oh, wow.
I came to Maine and started being a writer or writing poetry 30 years ago, and I wrote all about being in Maine. I had closed the door on my childhood and Ohio and the 60s and college. It was like all of that was sort of like an other era, and I totally settled into Maine. And Mary Weaver said I arrived like Mary Poppins. And it was like this was my world, and I wrote about Maine and wrote about raising kids here and spending time on the islands.
Yeah, you wrote a piece for Mothering Magazine.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I loved doing all that. And I even started grad school to keep working on poetry. And when my daughter left home, of that I really wanted to deepen my skills as a writer and as a poet. And then part of grad school is they push you into more uncomfortable territory. And then I also had heart surgery. And
I didn't know that
heart procedure, my worst fear, I had this strange thought that I was going to lose poetry from this heart surgery. And the strange thing is that I did, that poetry vanished. And I had a long recovery, and I got fluid around my heart, and I had this violent cough, and I had to stay very still and breathe very shallowly for about 6 weeks and stay home. And hardly anyone knew that I was still sick. I had some friends who would bring food every so often. But in this isolation, this strange thing happened of I was catapulted back into my childhood. And I remembered vividly being 7. This is where I started. I remembered lying in bed. So I was lying on this window seat, recovering. And then I'd close my eyes, and I could see vividly the wallpaper on the wall. And I'd remember where I'd pick my nose and put my snot on the wall.
That's a good one.
It was that level of vividness. And then I remembered racing from my bed and jumping so the witch wouldn't grab my ankle under the bed. There are so many people who had that fear of something grabbing them.
It's a children's story.
And then I'd lie in bed, and I could imagine looking at the light through the door at night. And I remembered that I had imagined sort of the house would being upside down, and I'd walk around the house on the ceiling. So it was a strange being returned to my childhood when we lived in an old-fashioned house, an old Victorian. And I had this commitment to write whatever would come up. So I thought, okay, I'm not writing poetry. I don't know what this is, but I'll just start writing them. It was almost like writing a dream. I just started writing an account of what I was thinking about. And I was writing in a child's voice. So it was like a little girl talking. And meanwhile, I'm in grad school and supposed to be sending in 25 pages a month of poetry. And I remember telling my mentor, I don't know what's happening. And he said, well, just follow it. Just keep, when you're compelled to write, you just do it. So eventually, the memories of 7 turned to 10, age 10, then to teens, and then I remembered and started writing about moving into the glass house and when we built it, and remembering about my dad having certain jobs. And so it was, the story came to me and demanded to be written. And I remember even when I was starting to get close to it, one of my colleagues at grad school said, well, the story you really need to write is about your dad. I went, I don't want to write about my dad. I've been making sure I don't write about my dad. And she said, that's the story you have to tell.
Wow. Well, much of the book is written in the style of the 50s, I thought. Upbeat, a story told from a position of privilege that we were being told all the time.
Right.
You know, Leave It to Beaver or whatever. Upbeat story of everything you know, being kind of
positive. This is how it all looks like.
The darker perspectives of your father and the shadow of his building put on the community. I mean, it was so interesting to watch it evolve in that way. And I was wondering if that was intentional. I have a lot of questions about intentionality.
Yeah.
Did you have that idea?
And part of it is that I started writing in this child's point of view first. And since I had been a poet for so long, I had to really discover what it was to write prose. And I had to discover what was the right voice for this story. Mm-hmm. So sometimes later when I was writing about architecture, I got really into this sort of architectural historian kind of voice. And sometimes when I was writing about the city of Cincinnati or about the riots or about different sociological phenomena that were going on, it was almost like a sociological kind of voice. But I also wanted to have sort of a voice of a family, of people really talking to each other. I wanted dialogue that felt natural. I wanted dialogue. So I need to learn how to create scenes that were like in novels, but real life scenes. So I was putting all these voices together, but part of the early, late 50s, early 60s was this really upbeat time. And part of modernism was this was so exciting. It was this incredible utopian fantasy of how modern, simple design was going to change the world. And it did change the world. It just had a huge shadow.
Yes, it did.
So I wanted that to slowly, and it's sort of how I wrote it, but it also was part of, it's like I wanted the shadow to slowly creep up on you. It was so interesting going back to the village where I lived, Glendale, Ohio, 50 years later, thereabouts, and bringing this book. And it was like telling the story of how we saw Glendale as a child and then telling the understory, the dark story. And 50 years later, people were still utterly shocked. They had no idea what was going on. And so many of our families, you didn't know what was going on.
Right. We're all watching Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah.
Everything is,
Or Laugh-In on Monday nights.
The story, the telling of the story tells the story as well as the,
I find the language and how something is written and how something is told is in a really important part of what makes something compelling.
Obedience is a central theme in the story. Mm-hmm. You were so obedient, doing what was expected to you. The rare flash of disobedience, like the scene on the roof where the teenagers had looted the root cellar and were drinking the expensive wine, really shone. It was so relieving.
I know. I realize it's a terrible thing to teach a child that they can never say no, that they have to be obedient. And the irony is my father had grown up in this Victorian, very controlled household, and he thought he was Mr. Liberal, Mr. Modern, but he raised us as a Victorian patriarch, and we were never allowed to say no. One of the most revolutionary things my mother did when it was getting near the end of their marriage was one night cooking, my dad's ordered, he would order us around all the time, and he ordered her to hand him something, and she said no. And we were all stunned, and he was stunned. How could anyone say no to him? But it's terrible. Children don't know how to protect themselves. You don't know how to keep yourself safe if you're not told to say no.
Yes, my mother, she taught us, you know, obedience was next to godliness or something like that. It was a real theme. And I think it was a theme in the 50s. Mm-hmm. But you really carried off this obedient thing. You depicted yourself as such a good little girl. I wondered if this was partly a choice of the narrative, or were you really that obedient all the time?
I was so good.
Wow. Stunning.
Yeah. I was such a good little girl. And breaking away from that, and sort of, it took an incredible act of courage. And still, it's like I have so ingrained to be thoughtful and attentive and caring. And it's this huge thing to speak up and to go against what's being said. And yeah, it's like breaking the programming.
Yeah.
My middle brother was the one who saw through the lie really early on, and he'd look at me like, Oh my God. You believe that?
Yeah.
And he's an incredible truth speaker, and it had a big cost on him as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have such admiration for him.
I heard somebody saying last week that they were so frustrated with people who didn't follow the rules.
Mm.
And I think that that can come up in any situation. There are people who just, they not only follow the rules, they want everybody else to follow the rules. And when it doesn't happen, they just get really upset.
Mm.
And yet the world needs people who don't follow
absolutely.
The rules too.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So the book is stark. Without extraneous detail, it reflects the minimalist architecture your father loved. I wonder again if that was intentional.
It's interesting that one of the things I had to do moving from poetry to prose is poets love description. And I had to, and we love adjectives. And I had to simplify my language. And I had to, as someone said, it has to be less gorgeous or less lyrical. So I sort of carved it down and made it more stark. And also, it was a really interesting thing. One of my mentors said, okay, because I had written so much at the beginning about the interpersonal connections and the family dynamics. He said, you have to show us the house. And you have to show us what it was like living in it and what the light was like and how it affected you living in this glass and steel and wood place. And so in a way, writing about it made my language more stark and simple. And because I had to have it be this sort of simple, elegant, but austere language to describe that kind of architecture.
Once again, the writing reflecting.
Yeah, the writing
story.
Reflecting. And it was also this incredible thing of reimmersing myself in my memories of, I remembered, there are a lot of scenes that happen at the dinner table. So if you imagine this long wooden dinner table and we're seated around the table and it's getting dark and there's a whole glass wall on the other side of us and it turns into a dark mirror.
I remember that scene
and
very
it's
well.
So haunting, and to have to be a child growing up and a teenager is always looking in the mirror. It's like, how's my hair? How's this? Or how's the outfit? But realizing I was watching my family like a play, and a lot of people said the memories of your book are so visual, mm-hmm. and I realized the emphasis on art and architecture were so visual, but we were watching ourselves. And it was, so I had, when I'd go back to write a scene, it was if I'd step into it like I was walking on a stage of a play. And I could walk around each of the players and I could see what my mom was wearing and what she was cooking for dinner and how my brother's haircuts looked and what music was on the record player. And then remembering, oh, right, my dad's face would get really sweaty when he got mad and was lecturing us. And then remembering how I would look at the dining room table and stare at the wood patterns in the wood. And that I realized it was so sort of in my memory as visual.
Mm-hmm.
And then the inner voice. So I think writing from that visual memory also made it sort of a more simplified language.
This is Jennifer Hill. The show is Finding Common Ground, and we're here today with Elizabeth Garber, author of Implosion, Memoir of an Architect's Daughter. So, once again, I did want to read a passage from your book. Maybe you could read some later, too. But the tension seems to be built into the narrative once again in this passage, which I found so,
taut.
And even in a situation where it's an everyday situation, but, I'll read it. I ran into the bathroom and glared at the cold walls of polished tiles, of green marble stones set closely in grout. My father declared that as a modernist, we were forbidden to close the doors and chastised us for false modesty if we tried to sneak the solid birch door shut. The brushed steel door handle's precise click would give us away. Mm. There's so much tension in that moment. You can just see the person, like you say, visually trying to, can I shut this door without making a sound?
Yeah, I realize there's a lot of tension living in that circumstances. And on Monday nights when my dad wasn't home, we would have so much fun.
Yeah.
And the irony is my father went to this Cincinnati Literary Club on Monday nights, every Monday night, even if it was Christmas, we would joke. And my mother's father, who was a more Victorian patriarch, he was at Literary Club on Monday nights. It was sort of the 100 men of Cincinnati. And it was like Laughing was on Monday nights, and we would have cube steaks, and we would just play around, and it was like the release of tension was unbelievable. Because the tension of how my dad expected us to live
really
and what
across.
He expected us to do was just relentless.
I think about like modern literature or movies or whatever. And we're watching, you know, you open the book and the first thing, there's a murder. And then there's a, you know, somebody, this is boom, 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 every boom, 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 something happening. But when you can go into the everyday and the shutting of a door can be so fraught with tension, it's like, to me, that's so much better than all this blood and gore trying to get you, you know, going.
Thank you for noticing that so carefully. It was like I would try to get into recreating that experience, but it's so great when someone else reflects back that they notice it was like, oh, wow, right. I was just trying to capture it, but you got it. It's like, it's very exciting.
Yeah. Your father was a broad thinker. He was brave in standing up to the culture of his time. These are my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Does his bravery affect you more positively now as you reflect on his life?
Mm. What was really great about doing the research on this book, and I'm so glad I started it when I did, because some of the people he worked with or co-op students were still around when I started doing the research about 8-10 years ago, and some of them have now died. But I got to hear about what an extraordinary, inspiring teacher he was, and of architects. And he loved adoring students, and children are not adoring students necessarily after a certain point.
Yeah.
And then I realized how much I had learned about architecture from him that my brothers hadn't, but as being firstborn, I just soaked it up. I just wanted to learn, and he told me all these things, and that I realized I had a lot to share with architectural historians who wanted to learn about his work. And there was one architectural historian, he and I have exchanged hundreds of emails where he would ask me something or I'd ask him something, and he's really building a lot of documentation and essays writing about my father's work, because it's early modernist buildings are disappearing and getting torn down and replaced with McMansions for houses. But I realized what a leader and how creative and how innovative my dad was, and how I've been able to help the documenting of that, and so that people can understand it, and that he can be, you know, an inspiring architect for young architects, which is very satisfying.
I was interested in the story, how it progressed, that the prejudice against, you know, anything new is like, oh, no, we can't have that. And how really opposed people were to this. I mean, all you have to do is in reading the story, see the precursors of today. I mean, you walk into buildings and, I mean, I love modernist stuff,
right?
But back then, it was that
there were
hideous.
Riots against modern art when it first started appearing, and then there were. My dad had to fight for every building, and he said I should have just become a lawyer because all I've been doing is fighting and paying lawyers. And
doesn't life feel like that sometimes?
Yeah. So he was just battling.
I mean, if you're doing anything that's original or
yeah, he was
different.
The icebreaker, and. And there's this battle between innovation, progressive values, changing things around, turning things upside down, and that comes up against conservatism, and conservatism mm-hmm. wants things how they always have been, and fights the new or the modern. And there was this natural battle between conservatism and modernism. Mm. And he was on the front lines.
Courageous guy.
Yes, he was.
Just to be able to stand up to all that. I mean, I find, I wanted to talk a little bit about art versus craft. I don't know, mm-hmm. versus, but art and craft, and how all this plays out, not only in your writing, but in your father's work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the innovation on the front end. To me, I've always seen it this way. And then there are people who kind of copy and make it popular and, mm-hmm. oh, come on, the PR people. Oh, this is really great. Where do you see yourself on the continuum? Do you feel like an artist that you're trying to break new ground, or that you just wanted to tell a story?
That's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure. I felt I had a story that I needed to tell. I studied the craft of memoir and studied lots of memoirs to find ones that I felt were compelling, because a lot of them don't hold my attention. So I felt I was trying to figure out how to craft a story that would hold people's attention and be compelling. And I've gotten the feedback that I succeeded with that, that it was unputdownable, some people said. So I don't know exactly what I did and how I did it, but I worked on it 10 years, right?
And crafted. Don't you like about memoirs?
When I was in grad school, at the end, I had to do a bibliography, and I made this pile of memoirs that I had read that couple of years, and it was about 3 feet high. And I realized most of them had bookmarks in them that were about half or two-thirds of the way through.
That's as far as you got.
They started out with a bang, and they were interesting, and then they sort of get into, oh, and this happened, and this happened, and they lagged. And I thought, you have to do a lot to keep something holding people's attention.
And how did you achieve that? Is that part of the voices, the change?
Part of the voices. Also, the last editor I worked with was a screenplay writer and a playwright. And she took me back to looking at the three-act structure that we study in high school about, you know, the narrative arc of a novel or the narrative arc of a play, and there has to be rising action, and then there have to be pauses, and then rising action and crisis and conflict and rising towards. So she worked with me on how to structure this story so it was moving towards this big crisis point. And then when the big crisis is over and letting up, you think, oh, I can relax. And then there's something that's even worse or even more than you thought before.
Sounds like our present government.
Yeah, exactly. Relentless. Sometimes it's too relentless. And then she said, every chapter has to have a narrative arc as well. It has to start in one place and end somewhere else. And one of the things I love about Harry Potter books, I read them out loud for my kids when they were little, and then we'd listen to them on road trips, is she always ended every chapter in a way that you just had to read the next. It just sort of, and she layered a story back and forth. So it was like, all right, how to not do too much foreshadowing, but intimations of something coming, and, oh, this isn't how it looks, and learning how to sort of plant seeds of threads that you're going to follow through the book, and that one thread will come up and go for a while and then resolve and then another one. And then I still didn't know how I was going to end the book. And then after a pause, I came around to it all again and put some pieces together and went, that's how it's going to end. And then I realized, oh, someone would think I just started perfectly with, this is where it's going to begin on Nantucket at this house. And it ends at that. And that
kind of nice sandwiching
just arose.
Wow.
In the last, in the eighth year. Right.
So that's interesting. So where would you put your father on the continuum of artist? What do you feel like he was out front, or was he, like, I know that there were people that he liked that came before him, but did you feel like he was out on the front lines?
He was out on the front lines. He really admired his teachers and felt really really acknowledged them, and he really disrespected people who didn't, who thought they had just arrived, like Frank Lloyd Wright. He hated Frank Lloyd Wright, and who didn't acknowledge his teachers and thought he was the one and only. But so he saw himself on a continuum of teachers, of really fine teachers. But then he was going on ahead in ways that he felt like he was breaking a wave. I don't really have a sense of who he felt sort of carried that style or that continuum beyond him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The story you wrote is very personal. In the writing of it, I was wondering if you worried how people around you would feel about the details of your growing up, especially your mother.
It was amazing, the process of, and it's good that it took 10 years before the book came out, because early on, when I realized what I was writing about and I started asking my mother and brother questions, my mother's first response is, well, you know your brothers and I will never read this book. She said, why are you writing about that horrible man? Why would anyone want to know about him? And I said, well, I had a different childhood than my brothers did. I learned a lot about art and architecture. She went, all right, you did. Okay. And I heard her in the kitchen. It was like at Thanksgiving or something, saying, Elizabeth's book is about architecture. It was like, and then it framed it. And I could, she said, you can ask me things about what happened when we lived in the old fashioned house. Don't ask me about what happened in the glass house. And you can ask about what's later, because she started having nightmares of what it took for her to break away. But what's been amazing is with my brothers, my middle brother, I asked lots of questions. He goes, I can't go there anymore. I've been spending my whole life pushing it down and pushing it away. I can't think about it. But he read the whole book twice at great personal risk, to it stirring up depression, stirring up pain. And he's actually started doing personal work and exploring what happened and acknowledging that he had has PTSD.
Trauma.
From his, yeah. He has trauma. And my youngest brother, who I sent all these questions to, and he, the first time he responded with 10 pages of all the horrible things that happened with his dad, because he lived with my dad after the divorce.
All right.
And then about a week later, he sent me 10 pages of all the really happy memories he remembered with his dad. And he said, if I hadn't written down all those horrible things, I never would have remembered the good things. And then a while later, it was my mom's 80th birthday, and he wrote 10 pages of all the happy memories of his childhood with my mom. That's worth the price of admission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
10 years of life.
and he hasn't read the book. He's read one chapter. Wow. There's a really happy chapter of a friend of ours appearing in our lives. So it's like he doesn't want to go back there. But my mom was really brave. At one point, about 7 years ago, she said, okay, I want to read it. I want to read an early version to get all this stuff before you cut it out. And she read it, sort of, she went, okay, been there, done that. And she just sort of blew it off. But when I got the advanced reader copies last winter, and it's dedicated to my mom and to my brothers, and I handed it to my mom and I said, I know this is a very painful gift, but I want to give it to you and thank you. And she sat down and she read the prologue and she said, wow, can you write? She said, I forgot if I was you or if I was me, and I forgot where I was. And she said, okay, I'm going to get all my chores done, and tomorrow I'm going to just read it from one cover to cover. And she called me that was a Saturday. She called me at about 11 in the morning, giddy and laughing. She said, it is so funny. Your dad is lecturing your boyfriend and your boyfriend's not listening, and or he's listening, but he's not going to obey. And she said, how soon do I leave the marriage? I go, it's a few more years. She said, I was afraid of that. But it was like for my mom to have that kind of, to be able to observe it. And she said, and a lot of times she felt like she was me rather than herself. So she got to break out of that traumatic experience. And the trauma comes back other times for her as well. But that was fantastic.
Mm. Well, this is Jennifer Hill, and I'm here today on Finding Common Ground with Elizabeth Garber, author of Implosion, Memoir of an Architect's Daughter. This is Belfast Community Radio, WBFY 100.9 FM in Belfast, Maine. And we're streaming live at BelfastCommunityRadio.org. We have a call-in function if you'd like to ask or make a comment of Elizabeth. The number is 338-2277, and that's area code 207 for those online. Your mother's rage and your father's was fully expressed. Mm. They blamed each other and expressed a lot of self-pity. Have you found lots of people relating to a childhood with these elements in reading the book?
Oh, so many people. So many people. What's also interesting is I've talked to, had so many children of architects say the living room on the front cover, which is our living room, they said, that's my living room. We had the exact same furniture. We had the exact, it looked exactly like where I grew up. And then a lot of them said, my father or the architect picked out all the furniture, all the art, their mother's clothing, their mother's jewelry, just like my dad for our family. And it was just uncanny. It was an era of our life was this aesthetic event and everything had to look a certain way and that our mothers were part of the scene of the house. And a lot of these architects wore big, heavy glasses, whether they were circle glasses or square glasses or, and a lot of them wore bow ties because that was sort of the distinctive sort of cool architect look with their suits. And, so that was the architect parallel, but then there are all the people who grew up in really abusive homes. And so many of them said, I had to put it down, or this was too close to my family, or that they, it had helped them gain compassion for the bigger picture of the era that their abusive parent was coming out of. But
a friend of mine said she had it, but she hadn't found the nerve to open the book yet.
Yeah.
Because she's afraid of what's going to be in it.
I've had a lot of people, I heard about in the village where I grew up, my first reading in Cincinnati last summer in June was in Glendale, and there were 95 people who showed up. I had brought a box of 50 books. They all sold. All these people went home. My mom, one of my mom's best friends, stayed up till 3 in the morning reading it, but there were a lot of people who read so far, and they couldn't keep going. And this friend of my mom's kept saying, haven't you finished it yet? And then after the second or third day, she asked, were you sexually abused? She asked this woman and she said, yes. So what I realized is it's brought the conversation of sexual abuse out in the open for a lot of people at the same time as the Me Too movement.
Hold on, please. Okay, go on, caller.
Yes, I was just, it's very fascinating conversation you're having. It sounds like a really good book. I'm just wondering if there's a movie planned on this. If so, when do you think it might be coming out? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
And what's actually amazing is I was approached by Pretty Pictures, which is a movie production company, and they looked at it in script form before the book was out, and they really thought a lot of scenes would be really visually strong, but then they opted out on it. But I thought it seemed so
visual.
Well, it's
just been published, so.
Yeah, it would be very cool as a movie.
Yeah, it would be. I was thinking when you were talking about your dad and the other artists, when we were talking about art, and I was thinking about Tolstoy. And what a tortured life he had, and the books that came out of that, which are we all just get to like read and experience. And in reading the book, seeing, you know, as I said, the precursor for a lot of the rooms that I walk into now.
Right.
This person was pushing for that, and I wonder how you feel about like. Well, maybe artists like that shouldn't have children, or do you feel like that there was any justification for what you went through as a child.
And there's that myth of the tortured genius. Yes. And a lot of them didn't have children.
Yeah.
A lot of artists, or a lot of them did have children, or multiple wives, or...
The wives sort of took them off, yeah. I guess.
And as a kid, I thought my dad was a lot like Picasso, and I thought Picasso was great. Only later did I realize, oh, Picasso was such a bully.
He had issues.
had issues, and there was a lot of... There were similarities, yet Picasso was much worse, actually.
Well, you know, I think about Alfred Hitchcock, who was a real control freak. I mean, every single thing had to be just so. And, I mean, that's where these guys, the tradition they were coming out of. I mean, leadership has really changed.
Yeah, there's a scene in here where I ask my dad if I can pierce my ears. I'm going to, Anyway, I'd wanted to pierce my ears, and I had sort of, I can't find the section, but I'll describe it, that I sort of put together a whole argument and a whole defense and was very polite, and I made sure my dinner table manners were perfect. I made sure everything I was doing was perfect before I could bring up this conversation that we were going to Mexico and I wanted to get pierced earrings and I wanted to get my ears pierced. And my dad said, no, I forbid it. It was like, it felt like a guillotine. No, your body is not your own until you're 21. And I realized, oh, we were... his until we were 21. It was like not only what we did, but what we wore. He said, I watch you kids like a hawk. I have to watch because I'm an architect and I have to make sure everything is under control and everything goes right or people could die. And it was life and death, his controlling everything and making everything sure that everything moved along as it was supposed to. And his rule was just this adamant intense thing for him.
I think that actually that's a relatively recent thing, is that we've discovered that's not a good thing.
That's not a good thing. Not a good way of doing parenting.
That is the way it used to be. In a scene with your mother, after she had left your father, she throws a coffee pot against the wall. And I'm curious about your relationship with her, as she too did the bidding of your father. Do you believe that she was part of the setup to have you worship him?
And she was 21 when she married him and he was almost 40. So he was this cool architect who drove racing cars, and she was this awkward, naive young girl whose father had been very dominating, and she was dyslexic and she didn't do well in school. So here was someone who thought she was fabulous and wanted to create a life with her. And so there was she was under sort of his power, but they talked about a lot of things they wanted to do, about having a house and growing gardens and growing food, and
all that happened.
And
then came the 70s, and then she said no.
Yeah, and then she wanted to be her own person, and he saw that as absolute rejection and absolutely unforgivable.
Aren't
he said, you're not the girl I married.
Aren't we seeing that play itself out now?
Yeah.
You know, with the let's make America great again. Let's get back to the woman, you know.
Being a subservient. And
yeah.
I know it's this incredible battle of the people who want to control women. It's like this unbelievable thing about controlling women. It's like, come on.
Yeah. I was kind of wondering about that, about your mom, and I was thinking about like writing a story about your dad, and as oftentimes I remember being in France and seeing this tapestry of the Last Supper, and they were all men, and then the table, you know, there was food, so you knew the women had been there at some point, but they weren't included in the picture. And I was thinking about the story of your dad, and I wondered what the story of your mother would be like.
And my mom came into her own essentially from the moment she said no. And she had been slowly building up. She had been learning how to get her voice. She had been learning how to go back to school. And she was very courageous. And I talk about in the book about how my parents went different ways after the riots of 1967. that my mother became a radical really became a committed activist for social change, and my father became an activist for preserving modernism at all costs, no matter what it meant to our family or children. Or, and my mother, during the riots, hundreds of African Americans were put in jail, and then after that, there were riots in the jail because the jail still had straw ticks mattresses. It still had buckets for toilets. And it was had been built right after the Civil War and was continuing as it had been since the Civil War. And my mom read about that and started going and doing research. And she amazingly enough had this vision of she was going to close the workhouse. But she started all these programs as a volunteer while she was in school studying criminal justice. The irony that she was studying criminal justice when we were locked in a cage, in a way, a glass cage. And she created work release programs and volunteers going into prison and talking to women and helping work on reducing the recidivism rate of people going back to jail. And then eventually when the marriage ended, she became a probation officer and still kept working on.
I think about, like, you know, why don't we write stories about women? The men we write stories about who, you know, the no, you cannot have your ears pierced. No, definitive no. This is a stark line in the sand. We are not going to go there. We're not going to go there. We're not going to go there. Right. And the box is drawn. And those are the compelling characters that we are fascinated by.
Yeah, there were a number of scenes about my mom that I thought, I realized the story had to stay. A story has to have a sort of the magnetic center. And the magnetic center was a father-daughter story. And I took out a couple of scenes that were more about my mom. I have a lot about my mom in it, and people have said, you know, you should write another memoir about you and your mom. Or, and
I think what was so interesting to me is your mother's character emerged as this loving, there for you, and the scene was so compelling of throwing the coffee pot against the wall. Because she was like, wow, you know, I was there. I did all these things. And, you know, still, you want to write about your dad or you want to, the
you
focus
wanna
is on your dad.
Still have a relationship with your dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, she, after she broke out, she was in a fury. Actually, there are a lot of books now about women's rage.
Yes, and, I know. I think that's great.
And she went into the women's rage for a number of years. And I, as the good girl or as a Libra, I was trying to maintain both a relationship with my dad and my mother. I didn't want to choose one or the other.
That came out, yeah.
And that was really important to still continue to try to relate to both of them. And that both of them found that almost unforgivable.
Yeah.
Right.
Because they were locked in.
Right.
You know, we all have to get out of that locked in, whatever it is. You're the mother now of two grown children. And as they break with you, which I'm sure they have by now, as they have to do in order to mature, how are you affected by their grown-up perspectives? And does that rankle you in terms of children see their parents' underbelly close up.
Right. Nobody can see you better.
Yes.
In an instant, or know the slightest like change of your eyebrows. They go, "You're mad." I'm going, "No, I'm not mad." Well, you moved your eyebrows. I know you're mad. And with both of my kids, there was a period of sort of separation or self-differentiation, which was really essential. But I feel I'm in a really good place with both of them now. It's great getting to your almost to their 30s or in their 30s. Yeah, I had to. You have to find out who you are separate from your parents and find your own way. And a parent needs to give them some space and needs to have them find all the things that are wrong with you. And
yeah,
yeah.
Which it all is reflected in the book. Do you think your father would have been proud to see you write this book about his life after you were born? It does seem to me like an adoring memoir with all its exposés of his darker sides.
I have no idea what he would have thought of this. But I had this amazing experience as I was starting to write this book, which was
And
he was dead.
Yeah.
I think I couldn't have written it until he was dead.
Yeah.
Do you know Sarah Bell? She's this amazing psychic. But I went and I just said, I want a reading. And you know, I had just a little short reading. And she said, there is this. She said, normally your ancestors aren't nearly nearby, but there's this tall, bald-headed man who is right there, and he's saying, don't remember just what was bad, remember what was good. And I felt like that was sort of one of my guiding lights for the whole thing. I needed to write about what was bad, but I also needed to write about what was extraordinary.
And in a way, we're kind of living in
the
good stuff
yeah.
by the modernism that surrounds us.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there were times when I was writing it, I remember going to see the therapist I'd worked with going, why am I doing this? This is horrible. This, you know, what happened to us and all the trauma. And she said, if you can hold a big enough, wide enough picture, then you can hold all of it and you can see all of it and you don't have to denounce him, or it's not necessarily forgiveness, it's understanding.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, what is the writing experience for you? Is it painful? Do you have to give in to strong emotions when you're writing, or do you just set them aside?
Time slows down when I'm writing. Like there were some scenes that I wrote with my eyes closed. I would type with my eyes closed because I had to stay in it. Like there's a scene where I thought I had to kill my father. And there was a particular day that I went, okay, today's the day. I'd been gathering notes and bringing things together. And I went, okay, today's the day. I'm going to write that scene. And because I slowed it down, it's like writing a dream and writing moment by moment, remembering things, I was so in the experience of resuscitating memory to write it that I was in the emotion and I was also observing and I was also how to write it and then how to go in close and then go out. And a lot of that structuring happened later, but I just followed that moment by moment and then how everything changed and I didn't kill him. And I remember after that, after I finished writing that scene, I just shook. But it was like I was knife focused. I was capturing one of the most powerful moments of my life, and I wanted to get it, and I wanted to get it in a way that felt true.
I understand Flaubert threw up and, you know, knocked himself against walls and just went through. So you felt that kind of
I just
strong
felt
emotion.
Like I was like on a razor's edge trying to capture it. There are a lot of scenes or moments in poems or in chapters where I've never read it out loud. And when I've read it, like one of my first readings, I read the scene about being at Harvard and feeling suicidal and going into the infirmary. And I had never read it out loud. And reading it out loud and reading the conversations with my mom and my mom going, you're going to get through today. You're not going to die today. I know you'll get through it. And reading it out loud for the first time, that's when I cried. And it took me by surprise because I'd been in writing. Right. I'd edited. I'd gone over it and over it. But then reading it out loud the first time, it's very powerful.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, Elizabeth. And I want to ask how people can get a copy of the book. And is there a way they can contact you with comments or questions?
So in Belfast, Left Bank Books has it. Independent bookstores up and down the coast have it, down in Portland. It's also available online. If you want to, I have a website, www.elizabethgarber.com.
G-A-R-B-E-R.
And there's lots about the book. There are photographs of the house. There are a lot of essays about architecture. My architectural historian nerdy self got to get it, you know, talk about some of my dad's buildings. And then there's also about the art of writing memoir and what I discovered in the process of memoir. Also writing about child abuse and what that took sort of in more detail. So I wrote a lot of, put in a lot of essays about different things. So if people want to go into further depth, but you can, it has a way that you can connect with me and write to me and I'll write back to you.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. And thank you, listeners. Next week on the program, we're going to have a show on insulating windows. Casey Hess with the Unity College and AmeriCorps volunteer is going to be on. And after that, on the 24th, we're going to be talking with Michael Hall at the CAP agents. That's not his last. Hallenbeck. Shorten his name. Hallenbeck at the CAP agency, the Waldo CAP agency, about public transportation. So we got a lot coming up, and thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.